Welcome to Local Motion. I'm Allie Lightfoot. There's a new report from the Economic Policy Institute about income inequality in the U.S. This report shows that income inequality has risen dramatically in every state, including Colorado, since the 1970s. Today, we'll be speaking about that gap in Colorado, why it's there, why it's rising, and how it's affecting the state. I'm speaking with Claire Sheridan from the Colorado Center on Law and Policy, who studied this report. Welcome to Local Motion, Claire.
Thank you for having me.
So first, I'm hoping that you can tell me how this report was conducted. How was this information compiled?
So the Economic Policy Institute is a national organization that publishes studies conducted through the Economic Analysis and Research Network. So this new report on income inequality is actually the fourth in a series of that is updated as new data become available. Typically, reports on wages and income are derived from current population surveys and the American Community Survey, which is U.S. Census data, so it's self-reported. But this analysis is unique because it examines trends in the top incomes from data published by the IRS on taxpayer income. So knowing the amount of income and the number of taxpayers in each income bracket allows researchers to examine statistical distributions and threshold values for different percentiles of income. So this data was analyzed by economist Mark Price of the Keystone Research Center in Pennsylvania and Stel Sommelier, who is a socioeconomist at the Institute of Research in Economic and Social Sciences in Paris. So while it's not the most up-to-date in terms of data, the IRS data that was examined was from 1917 to 2015, and the current IRS data has not been released yet. But we're drawing on trends that we've been seeing over the last 100-year period, so we wouldn't necessarily expect them to have changed drastically in the last 2.5 years.
And what kind of work does the Colorado Center on Law and Policy do? That's where you work. What's your position there, and why are they focused on this issue?
Sure. So my job here at the Colorado Center on Law and Policy is a research and policy analyst. Our organization uses research such as this report, as well as education, advocacy, and litigation at the state level to remove barriers that prevent Coloradans from meeting their basic needs and becoming self-sufficient. So we sort of work in three different branches with lots of overlap in research and policy analysis, family economic security, and healthcare. The issue of income inequality is really important to our mission in our organization because many of our families and working folks in our state do not feel the benefits of this booming economy that Colorado is advertised as having. So growing income inequality coupled with these like skyrocketing costs of living diminish the strength of our economy as a whole and the resilience of our lower and middle class earners.
Colorado is a little lower than the national average in terms of the gap. Nationally, the top 1% earn around 26 times more than the bottom 99%, according to this report. In Colorado, it's about 21 times more. So the top 1% earn an average of $1,261,000, and the bottom 99% earn about $61,000. There are a couple of cities, both of them are located in western Colorado, where the gap is much higher. One of those places is Glenwood Springs, which is pretty close and almost in our listening area here at KVNF. In Glenwood Springs, the top 1% are making around an average of $2,968,000, where the bottom 99% are around $66,000. So in Glenwood Springs, it's about 45 times more difference. So the top earner 1% are making 45 times more than the bottom earners. Steamboat Springs, it has a 35 times more gap. So what's going on in both of those places that make the gap so wide?
Sure, and that's an excellent question. As a researcher and also a recent addition to the CCLP staff, I would like to acknowledge first that I am not an expert on the regional economies or microeconomies of every town and county in Colorado, and there are likely local analysts and officials that could provide a much more detailed account of the disparities in their own communities. That being said, the trends across the state are that we see much higher income inequality in resort towns and counties that are driven by tourism. As folks with excess wealth purchase second homes or retire in these communities, because they have higher quality of life and high natural amenities, for the same reason that we all love being in the mountains, right? The challenge in these places generally is that tourism-driven economies are dominated by service sector and seasonal industries that often don't pay self-sufficient wages. So you see a growth in the low-wage sectors of those economies in those places, and which drags down the median income for middle and low-class folks, and that creates that giant gap that you're seeing in Glenwood Springs, 45 times more than the bottom 99% in the income gap there. I believe Glenwood Springs is actually ranked 8th in the nation for income inequality as a metropolitan area.
Right, and then you see the service workers, basically the people in the bottom 99% there, struggling to find housing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, you know, you used to have these bedroom communities for places like Glenwood, and now the bedroom communities are becoming out of their price range or miles and miles away. So these people are driving, you know, an hour to an hour and a half to get to their jobs in these places. What are some of the other reasons why this gap might be growing in Colorado specifically?
So the trends in Colorado are reflective of trends across the United States. We're seeing the median hourly wage falling or flat since the recovery from the Great Recession began in 2009 through 2016. So despite the robust job growth that we're seeing and the historically low unemployment, in 2016 we still haven't seen any recovery in the median hourly wage, which is disappointing, and also contributing to that disparity. More recent data actually shows that the median hourly wage for Colorado is finally returning to those pre-recession levels, so the last 2017-2018 data after adjusting for inflation. But it's taken almost a decade for wages to return to that place. And in the meantime, the incomes at the top have just been growing exponentially. In 2017, our median hourly wage was $19.93, which is the same as it was in 2007 after adjusting for inflation. But the cost of living in Colorado has continued to rise year after year. So not only do we see the majority of workers actually missing out on the shares and gains from our growing economy and our growing GDP in the state, most Colorado workers have actually seen very little in terms of sustained wage growth over that time. So the majority of workers, on average, their wages are only up 2% compared to 2000, so it's almost 20 years ago. In comparison, we see the top 1% rising at incomes rising at more like 40%. One result of this sort of uneven wage growth is that nearly half of all the income earned in Colorado went to the wealthiest 20% of households. So this means that one of every $2 earned in our state went to the top 20% of households, while the other dollar was split unevenly among the rest at the bottom 88% of households. So it's a pretty stark statistic that we draw on heavily for the work that we do here.
So let's talk about the causes of this widening gap. One of them is the minimum wage, as you just talked about. Another one is the widespread sort of loss of collective bargaining in private industries, especially in manufacturing, transportation, telecommunications, and construction. Another reason that's listed is the cultural, political, and legal environment that kept a lid on executive compensation in all sectors of the economy. So this is a really big question, but how have these things been dismantled over the last 40 years?
When I read that question, I went and got myself another cup of coffee. So For a comprehensive answer to this question, I would point all of my fellow policy wonks and economist nerds to a very short book by the renowned economist Joseph Stiglitz. It's published by the Roosevelt Institute, and it's called Rewriting the Rules of the American Economy. But to summarize from that piece of literature, our economy, politics, and society have experienced a massive shift since the 1970s. The balance of power between private sector, labor institutions, and government has become less equal, and the result is a weakening demand amongst the population, reduced growth in the economy, and decreased opportunity. So our current economy is defined, as we talked about, by low wages and a lowering minimum wage and very high rents, which is the cost of living. It's propped up by these structural rules. So we see financial deregulation, very strong corporate lobbying power, regressive tax structures, declining union membership, and loss of worker bargaining power, as you cited earlier. This wages that have failed to keep up with the cost of living and structural discrimination across gender and racial lines. There are also these larger global forces of international trade policies, globalization, and rapid technological advancements that are displacing workers in our economy. And these effects have been exacerbated since the late 1970s and early 1980s.
How can just your everyday average worker try to change these things?
That feels insurmountable and overwhelming because the forces and the structures are so much bigger than the individual. This is exactly the sort of challenges that we at Colorado Center on Law and Policy are fighting for on behalf of workers who, you know, their wages are low, they're working really hard, 40, 50, 60 hours a week, one and two jobs to try and make ends meet in our economy that's leaving them behind, and they don't have time or resources or knowledge to change legislation. So at the state level, organizations like Colorado Center on Law and Policy with our coalitions and partner agencies are working to advocate for higher collective bargaining power, increased minimum wages, and those sorts of things. If folks are interested in getting involved or even sharing their story, we absolutely welcome that, and we would love to hear from folks.
This report cites cultural forces that have been putting pressure on wages to go down as productivity is rising. What are the cultural forces that they're referring to, do you think?
To be honest, I'm not entirely certain what the authors were referring to since they weren't explicit, and the cited reports after that don't detail the cultural forces that they referred to. However, when I think about the cultural changes that have happened to allow the shift that I just spoke about from the 1970s to now, we see a drastic change in the dynamic between employers and employees over the last several decades. So employers are now often feeling more beholden to their shareholders than to their employees, which perpetuates this drive of wealth to the folks who are already wealthy.
Do you think there's been a change in how Americans or how the courts are viewing unions, workers' unions? There was a Supreme Court case recently, and I'm wondering if you could just talk about the attitudes towards unions.
So this might not play as big a role in Colorado generally. Colorado historically has had fairly low union participation, around 10 to 12% of workers are engaged in unions. The Supreme Court case that you're referring to came down from the Supreme Court at the national level that basically did not require workers to pay their fees, union fees, if they weren't part of the union. So previously, unions could extract fees from workers that weren't even in the union for the benefits of having that sort of collective bargaining power at the table. And you see that in terms of increased benefits, increased wages, those sorts of things. Now they are no longer allowed to to charge those sorts of fees to non-union members. So I think at a national level, there may be something to be said for the cultural perception of unions, but it's not a big factor here in Colorado due to our historic low levels of union participation.
So Colorado just doesn't really participate in workers' unions?
Well, the historic participation of Colorado has been fairly low relative to the national average, and I don't want to diminish that because a large percentage of workers benefit from unions even if they aren't members of the unions. Hmm. So unions are able to, and many of our close partners here at the Colorado Center on Law and Policy are unions. And so we believe that unions are the strongest tool we have to elevate workers' benefits and workers' bargaining powers at the big table, right? Mm-hmm. So the policy recommendations that we could go through to talk about how we could improve or diminish wealth inequality in our state are often the agendas of unions. And I think there may be some cultural pushback towards union agendas in terms of the political perspective of folks who are having to pay those fees and don't actually want to participate in union bargaining.
Mm-hmm. So it seems obvious to me, and I'm definitely not an economist, but it seems to me that when you destroy the middle class, then they can't continue to buy the stuff that makes rich people rich. So my question is, how do rich people stay rich when nobody can buy anything that they're selling? How are rich people still accumulating wealth when there's not no one left to buy things?
Right. Well, and it's an excellent and perceptive point, and unfortunately too simplistic for sort of the complex economy that we have to interact with. So over the last 20 years, there's been an extreme financialization of the U.S. economy. And financialization is defined as sort of a growing scale and profitability of the finance sector, which includes banks and investment institutions. And they're growing at the expense of the rest of the economy and due to shrinking regulations of rules and returns. So, our federal government recently repealed Dodd-Frank, which were supposed to have some limits and checks on big bank power. So the emphasis in a financialized economy is no longer on producing products for people to consume. It's on making money from money. So it exacerbates the concentration of wealth. The growth of a financial sector diverts income that companies or CEOs make away from hiring more workers or expanding production to capital investments or sort of rent-seeking behavior that decreases productivity in our economy as a whole. So it's sort of a higher level economic idea that has been a huge driving force behind our economy that isn't well understood among folks who are participating as workers.
So basically, the rich are getting richer off of the poor people accumulating debt.
That is one aspect of it, absolutely. The increasing debt is part of it. It goes back to that relationship I talked about, that cultural shift where employers feel more beholden to their shareholders to making a profit and less beholden to their workers. So any increases in productivity of workers is not reflected in an increase in wage, but rather that productivity is then concentrated in shareholder profit rather than worker compensation.
Okay.
So yeah, it's a very high level economic concept, but it's so influential in how our economy has functioned and how this wealth inequality has been exacerbated over the last 20 years.
And if you're just joining us, I'm speaking to Claire Sheridan from the Colorado Center on Law and Policy. And we're talking about a new report that came out from the Economic Policy Institute about income inequality and some of the numbers in Colorado that show that income inequality has risen dramatically in every state, including Colorado, since the 70s. The last group of numbers that they're looking at here in this report are from 1973. Why did they not do one of these? Why has this not been done since 1973, I guess?
So this is this report is the fourth edition in a series of reports, and I'm not sure when the other four reports have come out, but it's been something that the Economic Policy Institute has been aware of and tracking since the turn of the century. The data is sort of grouped in two eras. So they looked intently at the data goes from 1917 to 2015, but the data was grouped into 1943 to 1973 and then 1973 to 2015. And part of the reason that they broke it down that way is that the early 1970s is really when we start to see this dramatic rise in wealth inequality. And it's a reversal, a stark reversal of the trends from 1945 to 1973, where income inequality was generally declining. So that, I think, is how they've framed their story about income inequality based on data moving from 1973 to now.
So you've touched on this a little bit already, but what kind of policies do we need to return bargaining power to U.S. workers and increase, you know, more political participation and boost public investments in the things that tend to improve our economy, like childcare, education, housing, healthcare? What are some of the policies that would help prevent the wealthiest few from continuing to take more than their fair share of the nation's expanding economic picture?
Well, thank you to bringing us around to what we can do about this, because it is something that Colorado Center on Law and Policy is working towards. It's not unattainable for us to reverse this trend in income inequality. In our country, between 1928 and the early 1970s, the share of income held by the top 1% was in decline. The era was characterized by rising minimum wages, low unemployment after the 1930s, of course, and widespread collective bargaining power in private industries. We also had a cultural and political environment in which it was considered outrageous for an executive to receive outsized bonuses while simultaneously laying off workers. So in Colorado, we have made some strides in that direction. So in 2016, there was a ballot measure that passed that approved an increase in the minimum wage in Colorado to $12 by 2020. So this was an excellent step in the right direction, and we believe more can be done to support workers in our state. We're working with a number of partners at the state level to advocate for policies that would increase the distributions, the welfare transfers, to sort of bring some of that that wealth that's being accumulated at the top back down to the bottom. And we're also working on policies that would help workers make more in the jobs that they're doing. One would be, for example, the earned income tax credit that we're looking at as a possible policy initiative that would give folks who are working a tax credit for any families or tax entities making less than $70,000 a year. And it's not an enormous amount of money, but it is a way to sort of redistribute that wealth, as opposed to and that would go directly to families that are working, as opposed to funding money through government programs.
So at the Colorado Center for Law and Policy, where you work, who makes up the group of people that are doing all this? Is it a lot of lawyers? And
yes.
A lot of lawyers. Okay.
Yes. Yes. Most almost everybody here has studied law in some way, shape, or form. We do have we do take on litigation cases at the state level, for individuals who are experiencing systemic challenges. So if somebody is experiencing a barrier in the way that paperwork is formatted or something along those lines, we'll take that case to the state legislature to advocate for benefits to all the folks experiencing that same challenge. Like I said earlier, we have a health care and a family economic security program, as well as this research branch that works sort of amongst all of the initiatives. And then we also work within a number of coalitions that work towards financial equity and asset building and those sorts of things as well.
Well, thank you so much. It's been great to talk to you about this issue. It's obviously affecting people in Western Colorado, where resort towns are definitely a big part of our economy here.
Absolutely.
And I've been speaking with Claire Sheridan from the Colorado Center on Law and Policy.
Thank you so much for having me.